Session number 22371, Reel 7.
John Howe, Reel 7.
We took a gate off its hinges and put this Scotsman on it and tried to carry him on the gate. He's a big, heavy man, and it takes a lot of men to carry a man on a gate. I was astonished. I'd never really tried to do it before. I've only tried it in theory. And you can't get hold of a gate properly. Added to which, I needed men to go ahead and make sure that we had a safe passage. If we're all clustered around trying to carry this man, we'd have been a sitting duck. Or sitting ducks. Anyway, we carried him. We just took it in turns to carry him on our shoulders, fireman's lift. And you know, I don't remember a single squawk out of him. He must have been a very brave man. It must have been very painful. Anyway, I had put a tourniquet on his legs to stop the bleeding. But he had bled like hell. And we got back to wherever the rendezvous was. I took him straight into hospital. I went with him. The operation was finished by then, you see, so the men just returned to barracks and I went up to this hospital. And because he had a vast amount of blood in the bottom of his trousers, as soon as I touched it, it all flooded out on the floor. The nurses were hopping mad. Anyway, they got hold of him and patched him up and he recovered. He was a tough guy. And we went back to barracks. Now, having started this whole exercise at dawn, it wasn't more than about 10 a.m. by the time we got back to the barracks. The barracks, as far as we were concerned, was an old school building on the banks of a canal. There was no electricity. It was whatever oil lamps we could scrounge around the place. There's plenty of scrounging because the whole town had been fairly bashed about by looters and the war generally. And there was a tram outside the building. A strange thing to see in the middle of chaos. Anyway, we had a warehouse full of stuff. And the Indonesian youths took to robbing the warehouse. You know, it was our stores. And so the sentries were told, you know, to do something about it. But anyway, a sentry disturbed a couple of lads who had climbed in and were busy robbing it. And they jumped out the window into the canal, so he shot them and killed them. There was a radical MP in the area at the time. And before this little beggar knew it, he was on a court-martial. And, you know, what else was he going to do? Well, anyway, the prelude to a court-martial is a court of inquiry. A court of inquiry takes evidence from every witness there is. There couldn't have been many witnesses. You know, this is all happening in the night. But anyway, there would be witnesses to say what instructions were given and so on. They could gather enough witnesses. And the brigadier, the brigade commander, I thought was a very clever man. Because he found some reason why that court of inquiry got delayed. A witness was not available. There's plenty of ways in which you can do this if you want. And one day they faced the fact all the key witnesses had gone home to England on demob, and so he was released for lack of evidence. And I thought that was very clever. I mean, you can compare that to what happened to Private Clegg, who shot that girl under similar circumstances. I told the parachute regiment, "What do you want to kill a brigadier with some brains?" Anyway, they don't like you talking to them like that. The parachute regiment can walk on water. Well, anyway, So we returned from this raid about 10 a.m. on, and it was Christmas Eve. And we...
This is 1945, presumably.
1945, yeah. And everybody was told, well, that's finished, go and enjoy yourself, got the day off. Mount some guards. And you went around armed there. This was a place of a civil war where the chap who served you at lunchtime would be killing you in that evening. A friend of mine got shot in the arm playing tennis, believe it or not. Anyway, the men, you imagine, you know, a lot of husky paratroopers went into Batavia. And you know, there's only two things soldiers want at a time like that. One is, the first is drink, and the second is wine. And the only drink available was in the native liquor shops. Rock cut. So they drank it, and they rotted.
In what way?
There was a running battle throughout Batavia between them, amongst themselves, against the military police, against anybody you like, which went on all night. Tremendous amount of firing. I can remember I thought we were having a battle, and back at our schoolroom we doubled the guards. But that what it was a parachute regiment letting off steam.
Were there any casualties?
I expect so, I don't know. All I know is that we were not the most popular troops in Southeast Asia Command. And I can imagine all these pompous people were saying nasty things, and probably quite justified. Anyway, we immediately were put on various unpleasant duties to guard some place, you know, in an isolated area. I remember there was a petrol storage tanks. They had organized a guard around there. Well, you know, we were soldiers, we did things like that. But that lasted a few days, and I do remember that is because the next bit of guard section was an Indian Army company with a, or a platoon or whatever the formation was, run by an Indian Army officer, a real grizzled old soldier, lovely gentleman. He didn't speak a lot of English, but he was most courteous, and he invited me to supper and my troop sergeant. I had experience in India, and I tried hard to warn my troop sergeant, he didn't believe a word of it. But the fact is, Indians don't have knives and forks. They eat with their fingers, and they're quite clever with it. And you get a bowl of whatever it is, and a chapati, and you use the chapati to, you know, to get your food from the bowl to your mouth. And they look most artistic the way they're doing it, but we always look pretty clumsy, you know. Anyway, my troop sergeant learned bloody fast that that's how you eat. And I had told him, when the meal was over, he'd give a good belch. When he retold the story afterwards, he said, not only belch, he let out a couple of good farts as well. But I can remember him hardly able to contain his laughter. Everybody all round the room, nice meal, did you enjoy it? Because they all contain themselves until they expect the host to belch, you think, but the guest to belch, do you? You enjoyed it, yes, that would be good. Then they all belch all the way around. This is the custom. You go along with customs, you don't fight them. Anyway, all of a sudden we went back to camp and onto another ship. And we went to a place called Semarang. Mm-hmm. And Semarang was, it's a port. It's quite a sizable port. Except that there was no longer a port because it had been destroyed either by the Dutch or the Japanese. The Dutch, I suppose, or the British, whoever took charge of destroying it. And so we had to go ashore in landing craft. And We got ashore, the place was absolutely deserted. And there were bullet marks on all the buildings and everything. They looked like a battlefield. Not a soul. So we got ashore and the battery occupied a school with other units occupied other buildings. Now the area is dominated by a mountain. And the whole thing has a slightly strange history, which is worth the telling. The local Japanese commander was called Major Kido, and he was in charge of Samarang. At the time of the Japanese surrender, he was received instructions to hand over his arms to the local authorities. So he found what resembled a local authority amongst the Indonesians, and they handed over all their arms to them. The Indonesians had never seen anything like it. They went around beating everybody up, shooting everything and everybody. And Major Kido's honour was upset. So he armed his men with sticks and stones and told them to go and get those arms back, and they did. And they occupied this mountain which dominated the town. Now when we landed, 5th Parrot Brigade, hardly got our knees brown with the time we'd been out there. We'd been there a few months, I suppose. The Kido Battalion became part of the 5th Parrot Brigade. And I think that's a unique situation. And they took turns in occupying defensive positions all around this mountain. There was a running battle going on there from time to time around that mountain. The Indonesians would come forward and take pot shots, and we would take pot shots back, and they had a strong point up there and would fire. I don't think they were very good shots, but anyway, they fired. There were very few casualties. Very few casualties from gunshots. There were a few. But there were an enormous number of casualties from venereal disease, let me tell you. The bloody hospital was absolutely chock-a-block with folks. It was the days of penicillin was just emerging. And I don't know what it was, but I think the local women were only too pleased to provide a service to the British troops. Or whether it was one or two girls who worked hard at it, whatever it was, they went down like nobody's business. I found it quite amusing. They used to, the authorities got pretty concerned about this. So they used to publish in Part 2 orders the number of VD cases that week per battalion or unit. But so it'd be a level playing field. They manipulated the figures so we all operated either so many per thousand or whatever it was, you see. We were only a couple of hundred, you see, so our figures were multiplied by five, you see. Some clever bloke manipulated the figures. And no time at all, we were almost having a sweepstake on it. What else could you have fun with, you see? These things came out in Part 2 orders. Anyway, the brigade went down like flies. And I don't know that the Indonesian girls are quite pretty. But anyway, I didn't have much to do with them myself, but anyway, the troops did, all right.
Where did they meet them?
I don't know. See, when they went there, the place was deserted. We went ashore, and right in the town, there wasn't a soul to be seen. The Brigadier Ken Darling organised a sort of perimeter around the town, barbed wire, mines, gun positions, which were manned, so that all entry into the town was completely controlled. And then quite quickly traders started to bring fruit in and things like that. And it was quite interesting. They sort of come in with big baskets of mangoes, bananas, tropical fruit. And gradually the town came to life. Mm-hmm. Not a very vigorous life. The Chinese community just, that all they had done is put their shutters down and hoped it would all go away, but they just put their shutters up when once peace was declared. The whole area was dominated by Chinese merchants. They were the go-getters of the area, as they were, probably still are, in Malaya. Well, Singapore, as you know, is a Chinese town. And round about that time, I got myself on a number of courts martial. I don't really know why, but I'd always taken an interest in military law and its application. And so I went along as one of the members. And there was one case. There were two chaps from one of the para-battalions had gone to a bank, and one stood sentry while the other one dug a hole outside. Mm-hmm. Well, that was quite a logical thing to do there. Anyone digging a hole like that would have a guard, so that's what they did. And they presumably had worked out where to enter the building. Anyway, they hadn't got into the building. Well, unfortunately for them, their platoon commander came along and said, "What the hell are you doing?" And before they knew it, they were under arrest. I thought it was quite priceless. This all came out in the dry tones you get in courts-martial. I thought that very funny. I don't remember any other cases, but they had been accumulating, I think, and suddenly the whole spate of them. My troop was...
Did you have some official duty in the court-martial?
Junior member, or one member. A court-martial has three members. A president, who was always a pretty senior person, a captain who is number two, and a lieutenant who's number three. That's what's comprised of the court. They then might have any number of juniors under tuition. So you would attend several court martials as a junior before you were asked an opinion even. Or you might be asked an opinion before your opinion mattered. But I attended quite a number of them in the UK. Oh, military crimes, desertion mostly, absent without leave, desertion. My troop was then put in charge of looking after an enormous water tower. It was a tremendous water tower on great long legs, and clearly this was the water supply of Semarang. So this pumped up there, and gravity did the rest. So we were put in charge of looking after that, as well as sort of the surrounding area. And nothing very drastic happened. You know, you're always thinking something's going to happen. It was sort of fairly thickish jungle with paths and sort of up close to it, so that they could easily have got up to you, but anyway, they didn't. I went up the top of this water tower. We could see the whole area. It was quite interesting seeing it all up there. Anyway, this is the time when the RAF chose to have a mutiny, which they did in India. And it meant that supplies generally got held up.
What was the mutiny about?
They objected to... they wanted to be demobbed. There's a famous man who led it all, went to prison, had it released fairly recently. I can't really remember. You know, there were a lot of sly jokes about, because they didn't get two eggs on a plate and this, but it was... I think they had decided, as far as they were concerned, oh, there's all these mechanics and engineers and fitters and so on, that they'd done all that was necessary and they wanted to go home. They were not a... You know, the RAF employed a lot of people like that. And the new Labour government. The atmosphere was, you know, was like that. Anyway, as far as we could say, we got no mail and we got no supplies. But in the town there was dehydrated meat and diced carrots in tins. And there's a limit to what a cook can do with this. And for the first time in my life I went fishing because we were hungry. Instead of catching any sizable fish, they were all minnows. So we caught a lot of these, like a sardine was. Just fishing off the Dockland Wall.
So were the troops really hungry?
We were all hungry, yes. Right, now there was a peculiarity in Indonesia about money, but it's always slightly difficult to explain. But it's quite important. When the Japanese went, seized the Dutch East Indies, they altered the currency and called them Japanese guilders or Japanese cents, as opposed to Dutch guilders. And they just printed off money. And they did the same in Malaya and everywhere they went. Now the local traders got used to dealing with Japanese guilders. They traded with this. But with the end of the war and the exit of Japan as an effective power, the Japanese guilder had no strength. It was waste paper. But the traders refused to accept Dutch guilders. So if you got paid in Dutch guilders, you couldn't spend it. There was no point in being paid in it. So the money just accrued in your bank. And everybody was given a handful of Japanese guilders every week. Go and spend it. It's waste paper. But the traders accepted it. And as the traders gradually opened up, so we spent it.
So these were the Chinese traders?
The Chinese traders, but also fruit sellers and things like that. I could show you one if I could.
Don't worry about it, because...
I'll show you one afterwards. I've got one tucked away somewhere. Anyway, So month after month, you couldn't spend your pay, which was quite nice. You just added up in your bank. And really, there was no limit to the number of Japanese guilders you got. You know, just here, have a handful. Waste paper. It's a commentary on money. No. Money only has a value if you want it to have a value. It's like a 10-bob note now. 10-bob note's no value to you now, is it? And yet it was invaluable at one time. You could have a night out on a 10-bob note. Well, anyway, we had our time in Semarang. It was not unpleasant, actually, except there's, you know, you hear a shot ring out from time to time. And around this mountain, particularly where the Japanese soldiers were, the Kido Battalion, there were shots every night. And I suppose people got hurt, I don't know. And at some time we had football matches. I remember we had a football match against the Japanese. The Kido Battalion. And the local people turned, there was a stadium there, the local people turned out and they cheered for whoever they cheered for us, I suppose. And we played against local Indonesian sides and so on. It was all quite entertaining. Oh, that's right, and there was the anniversary of one of the big battles of the Parachute Regiment, the crossing of the Rhine, so we had an enormous great parade, and everybody loves a parade. And I suppose they got out of a band somewhere, I don't remember, I just remember the parade. And we were there for about 6 months, I think.
Was it a happy or a miserable time?
No, it was quite happy.
Despite the lack of food?
Yeah, you can live with that. You can... When you want a very great meal and you have a fifth of that, you can manage with a fifth of that. It's surprising. The fruit salads and so on came in, so was fruit. Might not have been very clever eating it, actually, but anyway, we did eat it. We all thought the fellow who sold you fruit today was the bloke who was shooting at you that night. But how'd you ever prove it? And there was Kampon clearings, that I described as like the Kramat Kampon. That happened from time to time. I don't remember there was anything ever found, or perhaps it was. I'm never too sure why we did it, but we did it, and that was the program.
Was there ever any as much fighting as there was at Kramat?
No. I think we'd all had strict instructions about the rules of combat and rules of engagement, I think is the word. You don't make up your own mind, you wait till you're told. If a chap fires at you, you can fire back, provided you have permission from the Prime Minister in writing. And that's about the strength of it.
What rank did you have at the time?
Captain.
And the name of your unit was, again?
The 1st Air Landing Anti-Tank Battery.
The first?
We were the first. We were the first air landing anti-tank battery. Right. Because it was the first one ever formed. The first glider board unit to fly guns into action. There were subsequently 2nd and 3rd and 4th and 5th and 6th batteries and so on. But they were very proud of being the first. Everything they did was the first. They learned about gliders the first. Had men killed in glider accidents the first. Yeah. How to load a glider, and you, because everything, when you put something, a jeep and a gun in a glider, you've got to strap it down with chains, and then you need to get it out, and you're not going to land on an airfield, you always land in some rough field or something like that. You can land, well, with some gliders you get it out the front, some you get it out the back, or some of them, some you can go either way. And there are more stories about how to get out of gliders than to get in. But anyway, the first battery learnt all of these. They learnt it on various exercises and so on. So the first. Anyway, when I was in Java, we were the fourth. Because the first and the fourth amalgamated at the end of the war in Europe. You see, so we became the fourth. The fourth had taken part in D-Day and the crossing of the Rhine and things like that. So it was a meeting of equals. Anyway, we stayed there until whenever it was. Certainly about mid-summer of 1946. When we went back to Malaya, and we went up country, and the battery was at a place called Kluang. We were about 10 miles from Kluang at an airfield. And frankly, apart from looking after ourselves, there wasn't a lot to do. We went through the semblance of training, but Zimbabwe was happening all the time, though the army was breaking up. And all of a sudden, the 13th Parabattalion mutinied. They were down on the coast at a place called Miwa. I happened to go to brigade headquarters that morning, for some business rather, which was at Kluang, and they told me when I got up there. Now what they did, they arrested a lot, about 200 of them, this mutinies. That's your regiment. I've been a bit quiet about this for obvious reasons, but anyway, they were pretty well all a new draft of men that had come in, and they were stroppy and laden, and they refused to obey orders.
What was their grievance?
They've been pushed around, I think. Don't remember much else.